who have come from far and wide to be here. And so what we're going to do is each of them is going to share their experience, strength, and hope around denial for about 10-ish minutes. And then we're going to pass around the Ask It basket and see if there are questions or thoughts or comments. Everybody ready? Okay. Mary Ellen, would you mind starting for us?
Sure.
Oh, boy.
And the person you want to keep your eye on is our timer. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. My name is Mary Ellen, and I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I came in the class of 1984, and my home group has been, since then, Beginner's Waltz in Watertown on Saturdays. I want to start by reading. This is a pamphlet, Mary Ground Named Denial. And,
oh yeah,
thanks. And it just, on one of the pages, it says, this pamphlet, wait a minute, alcoholism is a tragic three-act play in which there are at least four characters, the drinker, the family and friends, co-workers, and even counselors may have a part in keeping the merry-go-round named denial turning. Alcoholism rarely appears in one person set apart from others. It seldom continues in isolation from others. So I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what's like now. Where do I start? So I grew up in an alcoholic family. My family is riddled with addiction and many other diseases. I've lost two siblings to suicide directly related to this disease. I had no idea that I knew I had a problem. My life was really messy, and I knew I had a problem. But I didn't know what it was, and I wasn't thinking about doing anything. And the person, my boyfriend at the time was an alcoholic, and I tried everything to get him to stop drinking. It got to the point where I would be laying out the clothes for him before work so he'd look okay. And I mean, I think about how obnoxious that is, but he did it. Like, that's the thing, he did it. And I thought I was so helpful. I thought I was virtuous, honest to God. And one day he went into treatment, not because of me, which really ticked me off. You know, it wasn't because of me. And about a week later, the treatment center called and said, would you be willing to come to the family program? And I'm like, family of what? And they said, family of Al-Anon. So I went because I hadn't had a vacation from my job in about 11 years, and this is a vacation. It was not a vacation. And when I got there, the counselor said to me, why are you here? And I said, oh God, my boyfriend's an alcoholic. And she just said to me, honey, you are sicker than he'll ever be. And that woman saved my life. So quickly, I found out very quickly that I was the one that had the problem, big time. And so she told me, when I was leaving, she told me where to go to meetings. She told me what I needed and blah, blah, blah. So 6 months later, I was a mess. And I really wanted to do things that I had been doing. And instead, I called her. And she said, she was from the South. Oh, honey, you just don't know how to live. And I was like, oh, really? So I started learning. I came to Al-Anon. Well, I came to Al-Anon right after that treatment center. And you know what happened? I couldn't be honest. I talked a lot, and I got a sponsor right away, but I couldn't be honest. And that was fine. Nobody kicked me out. And so the ways I behaved as an Al-Anon, I told you I set out the clothes for people. I tried to save my mother from horrific abuse. And just witnessing that violence is enough to really, really, really upset and influence my life. And there's nine of us, there's six, and then there's a gap. So I took care of the three kids that were younger. And I tried a couple times just to put them in the car and take them away, like in the middle of the night. But of course, I had to go back. I felt guilty. And I was overworking. I was working. I had a workaholic problem. And I worked for, I don't know how many years, 11 years before I got here. And again, I worked 48 to 60 hours. Today, people do that. That's fine. Today, people do that. They didn't do that in the 70s. So that was, thanks, Nancy. So that was one of the ways that I tried to cope with this. And doing anything to the extreme kept me from my feelings, kept me from relationship with a higher power, kept me from relationships with anyone, most of all myself. I was just going at a dead trot. And, you know, finally when I went to that treatment center, this woman strongly suggested, and this is just my experience, strongly suggested that I leave my family, leave my home, and quit work. And I was desperate. I was suicidal. I was desperate. And so I did all of that. And I'm glad I didn't know any better, you know, but I did all of that. And what I realized was I needed to get out of the circle in my family. I'm not a girl that could go back into my family to get well. This disease is way more powerful than me. So I realized how powerless I was and that my life was unmanageable. It was a mess. The other thing is I was living in isolation. It didn't look like that. I looked good. I smiled all the time, and I worked all the time, and I pretended all the time. I had no honesty, let alone rigorous honesty. But I got a sponsor right away, and when I go to meetings, honest to God, I would shake, and I felt like I was going to throw up. But I never left a meeting. And that was decades ago. And Al-Anon saved my life. It saved my life. I got a sponsor right away. I started the steps right away. I did a fourth step probably 6 months into my recovery. And God loved me for that fourth step. I did what I could. But at the end of giving it to my sponsor, she said, "Do you have any secrets?" And I was like, oh no. That, like, I couldn't tell her the last thing. And then she's like, whatever you do, you know, what is it? Because it's going to keep you back if you don't tell it. So I told her, and she's like, oh, I went through that too. And I was like, really? So I continued to come to meetings. They talked a lot about God, and that was fine with me because I grew up part of my growing up was in a home for kids from really messed up families, and it was run by nuns. And everything there was small, like the chapel had small seats for children. And I learned that God loved children. And I was desperate to be loved, desperate. Meanwhile, I should highlight, my family was royally ticked that I came into recovery. Really, really ticked. Nobody's happy, or I don't know anyone that's happy, when a person comes into recovery and starts sharing everything and starts, you know, telling the truth and starts, I jumped ship. I mean, that's what happened. And my mom had never been abusive. She was abused. She threw a suitcase at me and then told me she was going to get a lawyer after me because I was going into these meetings. I was like, oh God, this is what I come from, you know? It's sad but true. And if I didn't laugh at it, I just couldn't do it. So I developed relationship number one in meetings. I just felt like a fraud, and nobody kicked me out. And I finally was able to start to get honest. I finally was able to start to trust. The feelings I had were rage and terror. Not fear, but terror. And I just didn't know how to handle those. But since I wasn't going back to my family, back then we had dimes, and we'd put them in a payphone, and, you know, call people. So instead of saying, you know, I mean, I couldn't go back to my family, but the pull was huge. And so every day after a meeting, when I felt like going back to my family, I would call someone and say, can you just talk to me or come and be with me so I don't go back? 2 years into recovery, I had a horrible relapse. I had been treating myself really destructively, And I just I thought by then I could go back to my family. Now, I didn't talk to anyone about it, which would have been wise. I just did it. And it was not a good idea. So I've been very humbled. I've been very, very fortunate. And I don't know why I'm here and nobody else in my family got here, but I'm here and I'm staying. And I've developed a magnificent relationship with the higher power that has been evolving over time. I can't even define what it is. However, it's there. And I feel really, really blessed. But you guys taught me over time the disease that I had and what the solution was. And I will be forever, ever grateful for that. I've changed my attitudes. I've changed my behavior. I've learned how to be with people. I am afraid sometimes, but not forever. And everything passes. All of those things pass. A lot of shame, a lot of guilt, but each thing I was able to work through. And that is a higher power. And you guys rock. Thanks.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen came highly recommended to us, or to me, and we're on the phone together. It was like, we must know each other, but I can't quite. Mary Ellen, I'm sorry, in Boston, that's not like that hard to find. So, and then when we met this morning, it was like, oh my God, I've known you for 30 years. So it was just lovely. What a wonderful surprise. And we're also blessed that my friend Mary from my Saturday morning Quincy hybrid meeting came all the way up from somewhere on the South Shore that I'm not even aware of, but she managed to park before I was able to find the Albany Street garage, I'm just saying. So, Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Morning, Nancy. Thank you for asking. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mary, and I've been a grateful, very grateful member of Al-Anon for the last, 15 plus years. Hi, good morning. I will just start by saying I'm not a public speaker. I was driving in here going, why did I say yes to this? Why did I say yes? I was the kid who in kindergarten, everybody was running around looking for this missing child, and it turned out to be me. I was hiding under the piano reading a book. That's sort of the way I've lived my life. And when I got into Al-Anon, the first 3 months, I kept running from meeting to meeting saying, tell me how to fix my son. Just give me the magic recipe, tell me what to do. And everybody just kept saying, keep coming back. Then it was probably 2 years before I actually spoke at a meeting. And in that first 2 years, I did a lot of listening. But I was still in denial, even for a long time, even after being in Al-Anon for probably a good 5 years, I was still in denial about, you know, about how bad the drinking was, my role in it, what I was fostering, the environment that I was creating for my son, the rescuing that I was doing, and I remember one. Actually, can you tell me when I'm at 5 minutes? Okay, thank you. I'm going to tell three little stories, but they're all kind of connected. And one of the first ones is that my son was heading up the stairs, and he turned around and he said to me, I want my old mother back, because I had said no to him. I learned in Al-Anon that no is a complete sentence, and I actually was trying it out. And I said no, and I offered no explanation, no justification, nothing, just no. And he was flabbergasted, and he finally ended up saying to me, I want my old mother back. I don't like you. I don't like this. I don't like what's happening. And he said, is this what your little Al-Anon friends are teaching you? And at that moment, I laughed out loud, and I sat back, and I said, yes, this is exactly what they're teaching me. And it after, 5 years, it finally got in my head, okay, yeah, I'm saying no is okay. And then, so that was story number one. Story number two is, this is not the proudest moment of my life, but this is a true story. it was probably 2 years after that incident that he called me at, I don't know, 2 a.m. From jail, wanted to be bailed out, and this was, I don't know, fifth, sixth, seventh time, whatever. I lost track. But I went down to bail him out, and it was a really, really cold December night. I think it was 2011 or 2012, and I got to the police station, and the cop said to me, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I want to." And he said, "Do you know what kind of shape he's in?" Now, I had just talked to him a half an hour before on the phone, and he sounded okay to me. This is how bad my denial was, that my drunk son sounded fine to me on the phone. And so I bailed him out of jail, got him in the car, and he was so angry and so belligerent and so out of control. And I remember, as I'm driving home, I remember the cop saying to me, "Are you sure you want this responsibility?" And I was like, in the car, I'm driving, and I'm like, wow, he's really out of control. What do I do? Like, I'm at a loss here. And then he decided he wanted to go back to his girlfriend's house, which is where he got arrested. And he would have been in really big trouble if he had gone back there. But he started jumping out of my car, jumping out of a moving car in a cold December night. He had on nothing but a t-shirt and jeans. And this happened between Weymouth and Quincy. This must have happened a dozen times. And I kept getting him back in the car, and I kept promising him I would take him there, and I got him back in the car, and then we wouldn't be going there, and then he would get all belligerent again, and really, like, I mean, curse words like I had never heard before, and it was really bad. And the last part, 5 minutes, thank you, the last part was we were on Southern Artery in Quincy, right in front of the, where, like, the police station and Father Bill's and all that is now. And so he jumped out for like the 12th time, and he landed again in a snowbank, and he was freezing cold, he was soaking wet, and I was so full of rage, I was so full of anger at him, at me, at life for having to deal with this. I was like, fine, just stay there. And I walked back over to the car, and as I put my hand on the door handle, I heard a voice that was not mine. It was God, higher power, whoever, but it was not my voice. As I put my hand on the door handle, that said, "If you leave him there, he will die." And I hesitated, not my proudest moment as a mother, even as a human being, but I hesitated. And I said, okay, no, I don't want him to die. And I walked back over, and I convinced him to get back in the car, and because he was so cold, I said, look, just, we're close to the house. Just come back to the house. I'll put your clothes in the dryer, and then I'll take you back to the girlfriend. At least you'll have warm, dry clothes. Okay, fine. So he did get back in the car. We went back to my house. I put the clothes in the dryer. He passed out on the couch. And I realized that at that moment when I put my hand on the door handle, something snapped. Something about the denial that I was in just snapped into full-blown reality of how serious the situation was, and that I had interfered. I interfered. If I had just left him in jail, or I had just left him to handle life the way he was going, okay? But I didn't. I interfered. I'm the one that bailed him out. I was the one who was responsible. So I'm looking at him passed out on the couch, and I got the clothes in the dryer. Well, he sleeps till noon or whatever. And he wakes up, and I started to say something about last night, and he had absolutely no recollection. Nothing. The worst night in my life to that moment, and he had no idea. And that was a defining moment for me to realize, okay, this isn't about him. What happened in this moment, in this night, was not about him. It was about me. It was about me interfering. It was about me, you know, sticking my nose in, sticking my hand in where it didn't belong. Because he had absolutely no idea what happened. So that was really a turning point for me. And I behaved differently after that. I didn't feel guilty when I said no afterwards. We had some other incidences after that, but the other thing that happened probably, I don't know, maybe a month after that night, was a friend of mine said, go to an AA meeting. I was like, what? I belong in Al-Anon. She said, no. Why don't you go to an AA meeting, you know, and just listen to people? So I did. I went to a couple of AA meetings, and this one that I went to, I'm sorry, but this one that I went to, this woman was the key speaker, and she got up and she spoke about how she didn't start healing until her mother walked away. Until her mother stopped rescuing her, stopped enabling her. And it was a very emotional meeting for me. I mean, it was 10 years ago, and I'm still getting emotional, but her and I had a long talk afterwards, and she said the moment at which her mother walked away was the moment she started to heal, and she started to take responsibility for her own life. And That was confirmation for me that I was on the right path, doing the right thing, and that I wasn't abandoning him, because that was my worst feeling, was that I felt like I was abandoning him, you know, which I almost did that night and left him in a snowbank. So, I mean, physically and emotionally, I felt like I was abandoning him, but I had to work that out within myself and realize that I couldn't do that anymore. So that's my time.
Mary, thank you so much. My sponsor always likes to remind me that alcoholism is such a powerful disease that it hurts people who don't have it. Oh, sorry, thank you. So my colleague Vanessa is going to pass out pages. She keeps reminding me to use my microphone. And if people have questions that they'd like to address to the panel, we would be delighted. And the time is yours. We'd really like to share it. And we'll hold thoughts that maybe Lynn will join us at some point. Anybody want to start with a question or a comment? Okay. By relapse, do you mean going back to your family? Was any substance involved? And before I let you answer that, let me just say that, so I've been in Al-Anon for 38 years, I think, and I would say to my husband, the alcoholic, by the way, I've got an anniversary coming up, and he said, does that mean that it's been like 30 years since you interfered in somebody else's business or gave advice you weren't asked for? So there's a context for you. Ladies?
What was the question?
The question was, what do you mean by an Al-Anon relapse and going back to your family?
Oh. Well, for me, since I was trying not to be with my family, it meant getting out again, just get out, because I started to hurt myself again in many, many ways. My body took a hit, my mind took a hit, my spirit took a hit. I could not go back into a place that was full of the disease. Do you want to talk?
Yeah. Any thoughts on relapse? The questions were both about that, interestingly enough. So, what it means to have an Al-Anon relapse?
Yeah, to have an Al-Anon relapse is when I'm not minding my own business in any way, shape, or form, because I try and carry this forward into other areas of my life, whether it's with my mom, who is now 89 years old, or in work environments. So I catch myself anytime that I am not minding my own business and stepping, you know, beyond my boundaries, then yeah, that's a relapse for me.
Mary, decide if you'd like to answer this or not, but somebody asked about the outcome with your son.
Yes, I will answer it because it is part of the story. It wasn't really part of denial, which is what we were here to talk about, but the outcome of the story, it's a happy one and a sad one. In 2018, my son got himself into rehab. It wasn't an easy rehab. He had been in several rehabs before, and they just didn't take. This last time, he ended up in jail, and I didn't go to bail him out. I didn't go to see him. No one in the family went to see him. He was completely alone, and at that point, he was still drinking, but he was also doing cocaine and heroin, and he detoxed on a jail cell floor. The way he described it to me was, he woke up one morning with his face plastered on a cold, hard cement floor and realized he didn't want to live his life that way anymore. And that was his decision, got himself into a rehab, and he was clean and sober for 3 years. And we had the best 3 years that I think, prior to him being 10 years old, you know, that was the best 3 years that he and I ever had. Unfortunately, COVID kicked in, and 6 months after COVID kicked in, he passed away. He had an overdose. He had a relapse. I think it was a number of factors, but, you know, with COVID, he lost his sponsor. He lost his his AA group, he lost his NA group, and I think he did his best to survive, and it was too much for him. So, he passed away 3 years ago in October. Excuse me, 3 years ago in October.
Thank you so much. What do you do during your lulls in the process? Oh, sorry. What do you do during your lulls in the process?
Are there any lulls?
That's right. It's just skyrocketing to success.
Lulls.
It says LULLS, like when you don't think you're making progress.
I don't exactly know what my lulls are, but there's many times I didn't understand what was going on. There's many times I was ashamed, and to me that meant I wasn't doing the program. I felt guilty, but the lulls were when things happened between my denial and my awareness, and whatever that time took, my higher power was great, didn't give me more than I could handle at that time, and always had a solution. So after a while, I knew that would be the cycle, a problem and a solution. Hardly ever turned out like I thought it would, but I've stayed for a long time.
Welcome. There are some people here who have said that this is their first Al-Anon meeting, and we'd just like to welcome you and to remind you that Al-Anon says that, or suggests, that you try six different meetings because, like many of the other programs, we're an acquired taste. So you might not like us immediately, but other meetings may speak to you in a slightly different way.
I've experienced two different kind of lulls, actually. There were lulls when he was active and I was active and I was crazy, and the lulls were you know, waiting for the phone to ring, waiting for the next shoe to drop, and just being always on edge. And then after he was sober and he and I had established a really good relationship, the lull was that I forgot about those phone calls, that I forgot, you know, about the crises. I forgot about, you know, like days actually kind of became serene and peaceful and the conversations were good and it was funny and we had, you know, lots of great conversations. So getting the phone call, you know, getting that phone call was so unexpected at that moment. It's like 5-10 years before that, I expected it. I felt like I was, you know, just every time the phone rang, that's what that phone call was going to be. And then to have 3 years of awesomeness, which I would not trade for anything, by the way, but then to have it happen, it was more devastating in a lot of ways than I think that if he had passed away at the height of his disease.
Thank you, Mary. I know for myself, Al-Anon was my first 12-step program, and I always had trouble gauging where I was. You know, I kind of wanted to get credit or to know what grade I was in or, you know, whatever. And I think I was desperately afraid that it might not be working or that it would be like a crash diet where you go back to where you were. And so I was always asking people, like, what the secret was, you know. And, of course, luckily they didn't look at me like I was crazy. But one woman suggested I go to a treatment center and that I could buy 2 years or something. And finally a guy came over to me at a meeting and he said, my friend says that you look like you're in hot pursuit of serenity. And I was, you know. I came in with the gift of desperation, and I got to say, it has served me well. You know, I have never gotten so well that I thought, yeah, I don't think so, you know. So, but there are lulls, and there are, certainly when you're in challenging situations, there are times when, you know, as I was going through a divorce, there were still times when I thought, if I explain it to him just a slightly different way, he's going to hear it and probably be really grateful that I was able to come back to that. And about the second or third time, he said, yes, you've said that. I realized that it wasn't about that, you know. I was mad at myself for continuing to do it, but, you know, experience, strength, and hope, as well as hungry, angry, lonely, tired, can be a tough combination. Okay, so.
Nancy.
Yes, please.
The only other thing I wanted to say was that after every one of those crises calls, my next call was to my sponsor to make sure that I didn't do anything or say anything or go anywhere that was not healthy for me. So it was, having a sponsor was a huge, huge help for me because I could reach out and that person was just there. And it was my lifeblood. It was my lifeblood to serenity.
Thanks, Mary. How do you know when not to let go and when you should let go? What if the person is not drinking and his mental health or behavior is the issue?
Go ahead.
Oh. You got your own.
That's a good one because, in a nutshell, alcoholism is not about the drink. It's really not. It's about my reaction to an alcoholic, to anything I don't like. It has nothing to do with that person, anything that I don't like. And what was the second? Oh, I know, mental health. I believe that this is a mental health disease. Like, there is nothing that is not affected. So physically, mentally, spiritually. And for me, the only solution is a spiritual one. So when somebody is, well, if somebody is, I'll say, a dry drunk, I think it's so much worse than when somebody's drinking.
Any thoughts? I thought your snowbank story was an interesting example of that.
The what?
The snowbank story.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the things that I discovered about my son is that he did have a lot of, you know, behavioral issues and mental health issues, and a lot of his, you know, drinking and drug abuse was because he was trying to self-medicate, that there were a lot of other issues going on beneath that I didn't recognize when he was in his 20s. I mean, I just thought, okay, you know, he's going out, he's flirting with the guys, you know, blah, 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 he'll grow up. And it wasn't that. He was trying to self-medicate for a lot of other issues that were going on. And part of what, part of what got him the help he needed was to get with a therapist who actually recognized a lot of the things that he was going through and helped him get on the right medication and really helped him work through with therapy a lot of his issues.
Perfect, thank you. How can one disclose a secret life, or who do you start to trust?
Do you want to go first? That is a day at a time for quite some while. I didn't trust anyone. I learned that I couldn't trust anyone. I have really good instincts, but everything I saw, I pretended I didn't see. And actually, I don't think denial is pretending. I think it's accommodating to whatever is going on. And trusting people was very hard. It's part of why I didn't tell the truth to people.
Thank you.
Yeah, trusting people is very hard. I still have issues with it sometimes. Because I think sometimes, you know, when you look at your family or you look at your upbringing or you look at, you know, who you're surrounded with, it's like that's all you know until you really become an adult. You don't know any different. And if I can tell another quick story, I don't know if do we have time? Okay.
We do.
I'll tell another quick story, which is that one of my moments of arrogance and humility has come in the form of thinking for a long time that, how did this happen? There was no alcoholism in my family. I wasn't subjected to this, you know? How did my son end up with this? Because, there's no reason for it. There's no logical reason. There's no alcoholism in my family. You know, I didn't treat him that way. And I don't know, what was it, 2014 or so, 2015, I was going to an Al-Anon meeting, my Saturday morning meeting with my rock support group, and I was going somewhere after that, and I had to take my mother to the meeting. So I said, you know, you're welcome to sit in the car, but you're also welcome to come in, you know, whatever you want to do. And she said, yeah, okay, I'll go in with you. Okay, fine. So we go in, and there's like, you know, 40, 50 women sitting around in this room, and she's in the back row with me. And so she's sitting there for a whole hour, listening. We get back out in the car, and she's like a bundle of nerves. And by the time we get home, she's crying. And she was like really distraught and devastated. And I finally got her to tell me what it was. And she said, listening to all those stories, listening to all those people, like that really affected me. And I said, well, how so, Mom? You know, what happened? And she told me about her childhood, which is the first I had ever heard. And she told me about her alcoholic father and the abuse that she went through. Now, she's, 85 at this point, right, several years ago, and she's telling me all this, and how she used to hide under the bed and hide in the closet because she was afraid of him and how he would beat my grandmother. And I listened to this for like 3 hours, this whole journey of her childhood, and I felt so much compassion for her, and I all of a sudden understood her in a way that I never had, because my mom was one of these controlling people. She had like all the isms without, my mother never drank, my dad never drank. I mean, I never saw alcoholism in its raw form, but my mother had all the isms. And fear, controlling, I mean, you know, what is it, that Kelly Clarkson song that, you know, if you walk on the other side of the street, you're going to get killed, you know. I mean, that was my mother, that she was so full of fear. And that's how I grew up, and that's what I thought was normal. And apparently, I realize now that I un, un, that I passed on some of that fear to my son. That is a lot of the way I raised him, was that, you know, don't do too many crazy things, you know, don't get yourself in trouble, you know. And so I guess, you know, when there's missing pieces of family history, it caused me to look back and question my whole childhood. And it wasn't until I read the Adult Children of Alcoholics book that I'm reading that, and I'm like, check, you know, have you ever been controlling? Have you ever done this? And I'm reading the whole list, and I was blown away because I'm checking everything off, saying, wow, I was affected by this a lot more than I understood, and I was so woefully unprepared to deal with the issues with my son, where I feel like, had we been open as a family, had I known some of those stories, I probably would have been better prepared. I might have known the signs. Things might have turned out differently. I mean, no guarantee, obviously, but I think we would have been, as a family, better prepared for it rather than just, you know, keeping everything away. Nobody talks about anything. So that was, in my hubris, came a great deal of humility because I realized how badly I had been affected. And I accept that, and I work on it now. So that's all.
Thanks, Mary. I know for me, you were so nice to me when I came in that it made me very uncomfortable. I figured that you wanted something. I didn't know if it was a multi-level marketing scheme or just, well, I mean, you know, when do people give you that much love for free? You know, it's kind of, and so I was a little cautious, and you wore me down, you know? I remember like three or four meetings in, somebody asked me about something I had said at a previous meeting, and it was like, you're listening. Oh, you know, it just, but, you know, for many of us, we don't come in here with a lot of trust. Say, the next question is doing an intervention against Al-Anon principles, is that trying to keep control? You can tell the hard questions.
Al-Anon doesn't take any position. If people go that route, it's really none of my business. And if they don't go that route, it's none of my business. But Al-Anon does not take a position on that.
Yeah.
Sorry, can you read the question again?
Yes. It was about intervention. Is an intervention against Al-Anon principles, does it show control?
I think it can be both in the way, depends on the way it's handled. We did do an intervention with my son when he was sort of, I don't know, at the height or at the crux or whatever. It was, it was good in the way that my family did all gather around, my brothers, my mom, my sister-in-laws, we did all gather around, and it was good in the fact that everybody was finally talking about it, and it was finally out in the open. And I was one of the worst, because I was the one keeping secrets. I didn't want anybody to know. So when things all did start coming apart at the seams, It was good in a way for him and I to know that we both had support within the family, because I didn't know that I would. And so it was good that way. Ultimately, my son years later told us that he appreciated it, but I don't think he appreciated it in the moment. You know, he did feel like we were controlling. He felt like, you know, we were putting ultimatums on the table. And quite frankly, we were, because everyone was at the point where, you know, we were pretty much done with his behavior. And so, but it was we were being truthful as well. So I think it can be bad if you're like, adding like all these strings and, you know, you do this and we'll do that. And we didn't do that. We just said, this is the way it is and we're not going to accept this kind of behavior anymore. And if you want to continue doing that, you're going to do it kind of, you know, without us being involved in your life. So there weren't necessarily any strings, but there was a lot of truth talking. So.
Thanks, Mary. I think in many ways it's an outside issue. One of the questions was about how to find Al-Anon meetings in the greater Boston area, and online, Al-Anon.org, MassAl-Anon.org. Thanks, Vanessa. But if you want some recommendations or some ideas, please come up and see us afterwards. In your experience, at what age is it appropriate to stop interfering in your child's life? Uh-oh. And I have a multiple choice here. 14, 16, 18. I don't have children, so I'm going to let this one pass.
I don't have any children either, so I'm going to give it to Mary.
Okay, Mary.
Is six an appropriate answer? Actually, I'm gonna default to one of the things that my brother asked me, because my brother has one brother has three kids, the other one has four, and they witnessed a lot of, you know, what I went through with my son. And at the time my brother asked me this question, there's a reason I joke six, because my youngest nephew was six, and he had kids ranging in age from 6 to 16. And he said, what is the one thing, if you could go back and wished that you had, you know, emphasized or taught more of, or what is the one thing you wish you had been better at doing? And I said, just give me a day to think about that. And I actually came back to him and I said, the answer is that I wished that I had emphasized with my son that things have consequences. I think that's the one thing I didn't. I was too ready to just scoop in whether he was six and, you know, didn't get picked for the basketball team because he was too short, or, you know, he was 26 or 36 and I'm bailing him out of jail. So, I mean, I wish that from the time he was young, I made age-appropriate decisions about what the consequences would be for certain things. Because I don't think he ever learned it, at least not from me. He learned the consequences, but he learned it in a different way. He didn't learn it from me.
There's a question here about how, if Al-Anon can help in ways that the AA steps haven't, which I assume is for double winners. So I don't know if either of you would like to try that. You can't have my mic, though.
I want your mic.
Okay, all right. Yes. How can Al-Anon help where the AA steps haven't?
That's really interesting. I am a double winner, and I've done the steps in both programs. And they're just two different animals. You know, A is one, and I think my experience is when AA people come to Al-Anon meetings, frequently they're like, oh, these people are just whining, or, you know, I'm from AA. And it's like, well, me too. And I'm affected by alcoholism. So Al-Anon is for anyone that's affected by alcoholism. And I've done the steps multiple times in both programs, and each program has given me an enormous amount of freedom, but they're just different. And, you know, I go to Al-Anon first and do the steps there and then in AA, I think that it's a vast amount of knowledge, and I think both of them give their own kind of thing.
Not a double winner, okay. You know, as a double winner, I would just say it makes me think of Sister Maurice, which some of you may have heard her talks, but she used to talk about it as two sides of the same coin, you know, so affected by, afflicted with, she would call us twice blessed. And some of the, you know, the AA history would remind us that Lois and her gang was very much part of the early AA meetings. But I think it's just kind of getting at a different part of the problem from my standpoint. But boy, if you could have too much recovery, that would be a blessing. So I think, you know, whatever works for you. So we've come to the end of our time, and I just very, very much like to thank both Mary Ellen and Lynn, wherever she is.